I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. David Roche joins me now. He's just published a new essay collection, Standing at the Back Door of Happiness and How I Unlocked It. The book discusses his upbringing, the vascular malformation that he was born with, his serious Catholic childhood, and his devotion to the Democratic Workers' Party. Readers will find out about the journey he took to better understand how his facial difference is viewed by others and how he's coped with everything that life has thrown at him. The book is often funny, and it's instructive in how Mr. Roche has treated others with compassion, love, and acceptance. One of the better lessons in the book is how one's mere presence can do so much. David Roche is a popular motivational speaker and performer. He's taken his one-man show, The Church of 80% Sincerity, on tour around the world. He's had several roles in films and documentary, and in 2021 he was named to the Order of Canada. He is a volunteer for the Sunshine Coast Hospice, and with his partner Marlena, leads storytelling and writing workshops. The website for more is at davidroche.com. He joined me from his home in Roberts Creek, British Columbia, last week. This new book is from Harbor Publishing. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, David Roche. Mr. Roche, good morning.
Good morning to you, Joseph.
Thanks for joining us. We're on the phone, so we're not looking at one another this morning. But when people do see you for the first time, and because of your facial difference, how often are you asked when people meet you what the cause of it is?
Very rarely. When I first got on stage about 33 years ago, it was more common to be questioned, but culture and society has changed, and people with facial difference are a little more visible and seen as part of society now. So it's pretty rare. But once in a while they do. It's kids who are most likely to ask.
Yeah, there's a story in the book. I think you were at, you were here in Vancouver with a group, and a little girl does come up to you and asks you, right? And whereupon I don't think an adult would.
That's right. 4 and 5 year olds, at that age, they have a little more of what you might call a monster consciousness.
Yeah.
And so when they see me, that's when they triggered a bit. And, you know, am I a monster? Who am I? What am I? Et cetera. So they're more likely to ask. Oh, they're more likely to hide behind their mother's skirt as well. But again, that's going to be there too.
Yeah. What, so we live, David, in a society where, for a lot of people, beauty and self-worth come from how they look externally. How do we get away from that? We know that that's bad. We know that that's not probably how we should look at ourselves or other people even. But it is there in this culture, in our society, and we should work to change that, shouldn't we?
Okay, here's the first step. Listen to me. One of the things I'd like to point out is that people with a facial difference have an advantage. We have a better understanding of the human condition. And one of the things that I found out in being on stage, from people talking to me after shows, after talks, is that everybody feels disfigured. Now, it can be something as simple as a wart on your knuckle or a mole or, my legs are too fat, my legs are too thin, on and on. It can be internal, can be dyslexia, can be feeling of not being creative, whatever kind of thing. But that's, in actuality, the same as my facial difference. Because it has the same effect, it can have the same effect of feeling less than, and then spending lots of money on the internet on makeup or sexy clothes or something like that. But because I have a facial difference, I have been pushed, not to buy makeup, but to find my beauty inside myself. And you know what? That is something that everybody needs to do. You know, that feeling of worthlessness, of being ugly, of being stupid, of being fat, whatever, that leads you into a place of a lack of self-confidence and self-judgment, and that is where the predators come to feed. Sexual predators, financial predators, political predators, on and on.
Yeah.
So I'm just saying that those of us who are facial deficient have a little more access to understanding that, because we've been forced to.
Yeah, it's a wonderful. Yeah, it does make sense, and it's a wonderful way to go about life and think about one another. You know, you write in the book, and I found this quite poignant, this was not something that growing up you and your parents or your siblings talked about. And I'm curious to know, David, if you had talked about it a little bit more, would it have made a difference as to how you would have gone into adulthood, say, with the facial difference?
I do not know the answer to that, because that was simply not available to me, and I can conjecture. I can imagine myself looking as handsome as one of my brothers, but it doesn't come anything toward reality. I know other friends who, with facial differences, who, for whom their parents did not really talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that was denial as a mechanism of self-empowerment. And you can say, well, that's really messed up. And in a way it is. But still, it was something that worked. I didn't even know what was wrong with me until I was 30 years old and went to a clinic at the University of California at San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found out what my condition actually was. And that, you know, that worked fine for me. I also, the fairly straightforward here, I blunted all my concern with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I was not the kind of drinker that woke up on the side of the road or anything like that, but I used alcohol to wipe out any difficult feelings. Actually, that was prior to getting on stage. I had to go through two changes, and one was quitting alcohol,
yeah.
And the other was meeting my soulmate. So I had sobriety and love, and that came in my 40s, and that really helped.
And so you narrate what happened after you found your sobriety and you found your soulmate. But before that, as you write in the book, there are forays into politics. You fell in with this group, the Democratic Workers Party. It's a left-wing group. What did you find attractive about that group? Because as we read in the book, it also falls apart in the end, doesn't it? Now, not just as a group, but for you especially, right?
The reason I got involved was I was one of the founders of the Child Care Switchboard and Single Parent Resource Center of San Francisco.
Mm.
We were hippies. We didn't know what we were doing. And just listening on the phone, and I worked there for 8 years, that really opened me up to the reality of what it means to be a parent, a mother, a single mother, in the city, in life, in the United States, in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And I became politically active in order to try to change that. It seemed as a sense of responsibility. And if you want to push it a little bit, I think I was also influenced by being raised in a Catholic environment where my parents were very involved in community, kind of like the thing of feed the hungry, give comfort to the afflicted, that kind of thing. I was imbued with that as well. And that's what I was trying to do, not trying to overthrow the government or anything like that. I wanted things to change. It didn't. It got worse. So
yeah, and it, like most groups, you have what you want to accomplish, and others have what they want to do, and they're often at cross purposes. And I think that's one of the reasons why it didn't work out, right?
Very true.
Yeah. There are parts of the book that you, especially when you write about your childhood, that I find quite beautiful. Memories surrounding your childhood come back so vividly and viscerally for you in this book. What is it like to relive all of the past? And when I think of, you know, you walking through your grandmother's house, for example, and everything that you see, those are just wonderfully written memories for you, aren't they?
They are, and I think what's going on with that is a recall of the things that made me who I am, of being nurtured and loved. When I was born in 1944, my dad was in Stalag 17 in a Nazi prisoner of war camp, and nobody knew if he would survive and get home. So I was treasured. I was like King David, okay? And that got me off to a good start, that's for sure.
And as a public speaker today, and as you write in the book, everything from the past does come together, doesn't it? I mean, you as a public speaker are able to marshal memories, moments of grace that you've witnessed or heard about. Everything is a part of today, isn't it?
You know, I really appreciate your saying that and you mentioning it because a few months ago, I became 80 years old. And in recent years, I found that I am less focused on what lies ahead. What do I need to do? What do I need to get done? And I'm more like, no, life is not something that lies ahead. Life is what you have lived. And so my life stretches over the past 80 years. And that tends to be where I live. And, you know, you can say, well, this is just aging, whatever it is. It's wonderful to be able to recall those times. And I think I and probably other people need to do that to establish our own sense of self and how that was good for us.
Yeah, I'm 42. And as I was reading the book, I kept thinking about, you know, the memories that I have growing up. And, you know, there's a lot that I'd forgotten. And or a lot that I hadn't thought about in years, and it hits you, you know, that time is passing, often quite rapidly as we get older.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
It's awfully important, is it, to remember the past because it is such a part of you, even if you don't recognize it as such.
Yeah, very true. And just wait till you get to the age, Joseph.
It'll come faster, I'm sure. I mentioned you noted as a public speaker, but it wasn't always so, was it? I mean, there's a wonderful story in the book about you getting up to speak on a bus, and it wasn't easy, and it certainly didn't come naturally. But I found that incident so illustrative as to how people react to you. I mean, in that moment, there is somebody who wants you to shut up. But there are also very supportive people and very different people at that.
That was, thank you for mentioning that. And, you know, I appreciate the way you're delving into the book and you see things that at a deeper level. So thank you for that. And, you know, it took me, I mean, that story, that event was a turning point for me, but it's so deep inside me that it didn't come into my consciousness. And it took me, I would say, a couple of years once I got on stage. And so people would tell me, oh, that was really fantastic. And you changed my life. And I thought they were just being nice to the little disfigured guy. But they weren't. There was something that they should see. And once I dropped into that, that's when I should start to figure out that how the reason I had a good effect on people was that everybody feels disfigured. And so when they see someone like me being confident, it's a good lesson. You know, it shows what's possible for them, too.
Yeah, for people listening to us, it's a wonderful story in the book, and people should pick up the book for that. But I mentioned that there was a guy who wanted you to shut up, to be quiet, and he was a business. He looked like a businessman with a briefcase and such. And then the two people who came up to you and were very supportive of you was a little old lady, and then. The guy who picked you up from the back of your pants to push you up to get up and talk again. I don't know how you describe him. He looked like he belonged to a gang. Is that right?
Yeah, he looked like in a Latino. The word then, I don't know if it's still active, is Vato.
Yeah.
V-A-T-O. That's what we heard, the word to describe young men like that. Yeah.
It's a
flannel shirt, buttoned up, bandana around his head, things like that. Yeah.
It's a beautiful moment in the book because you really do feel, as I was reading the book, the sorts of people that form a community, and especially in your memory, obviously, these people on that bus, you know, they set you up to being the public speaker you are today, haven't they?
Yeah. And then there was that incident that happened in a black Baptist church. I think I wrote about that. It was a get-out-the-vote thing, and the pastor had invited us to speak, and it was me speaking, and I grew up Catholic. There was no talking in church. You know, you got a good twist in the ear or a slap when you started talking. But here in this church, everybody's yelling, and yeah, the band was playing, and it was like a party. But then I remembered, as I was going up to the pulpit to speak, I remembered an incident that had happened when I was much younger, where outside of actually a school, James Wick School in San Francisco, there was a group of young black girls, and as I walked by them, their conversation stopped, and they stared at me. And what did she say? This one girl said, "Ew, he awful," something like that. And that phrase, "Ew, he awful," that stuck with me for decades. And that was still on my mind as I walked to the pulpit. My left side, the quote, disfigured side, was exposed to everybody. But there was no sudden silence and staring. People were cheering and yelling for me, and you know, and yelling, "Praise the Lord!" And you tell the truth, and yeah, bring it on. And actually, that was a deep spiritual experience, because as I wrote, you know, my idea of God changed from somewhere up in the sky, from someone with holding a club behind his back with anger management problems, into I guess God became female and supportive, but that was wonderful. Now, am I changing the topic there? I don't know.
No, not at all, because I think it's also illustrative of how even little things we do in the course of the day that we're not even thinking about can change someone's life. And I think that's important not to overlook how we have that effect on people. Even, you know, even if we exclaim a personal opinion about something, someone will hear that. Yeah. And that'll stick with them, right?
Yeah. And so it seems. I really feel that now. And on my 80th birthday, I was told by many people, happy birthday, we love you, and you changed my life, you changed the lives of other people. And I realized I've had a really full and wonderful life. And the ways that I survived and thrived by connecting with other people. Also help them. It's a wonderful feeling.
You also write in the book, and I found this quite profound, David, when you talk about the importance of being present, you talk about friends who've died of AIDS, and this massage program that you started with your partner. Just how important it is to be present, especially at the end of one's life. Because there's also another chapter in the book where you talk about your friend Sid, who chose to end her life with MAID, medical assistance in dying. And we also live in a culture where talking about death is taboo or uncomfortable for a lot of people. And I found it, as I said, quite beautiful to read in your book. These experiences you've had around death and how important touch is, you know, especially at the end of one's life. These are things that we need to talk about, aren't they?
I think so, and it is difficult to talk about. My wife, Marlena, has been a volunteer at the Sunshine Coast Hospice for about 12 years, and she is always helping people who are grieving or who are about to die, including in the dying process. And with her as an example, I started doing facilitating grief writing groups. And they've been really wonderful. Wonderful, and I'm speaking for myself here, because once you start talking about it, it's the most human thing to talk about. You know, because it's death, you know, right? Death. You know, you can't have one without the other. So it brings up very deep and powerful and real and loving, heartfelt talk and communication and feelings and heartful connections.
And in a way for you, David, being around death as you have and being there for the person who's dying, that's taught you how to live too, hasn't it?
It does. I would say it does. And again, this is not something that I just go, snap, oh, I get it. It goes over a period of time. But it's also inexorable. And it's part of aging, part of being human, and like I say, if you have a disability, especially a visible disability, you get more access to that kind of thing, what it means to be fully human. And I think that's a strength of my writing. I had a launch party about a month ago, and the things that I read, as I read them, and that included the story about Sid dying with medical assistance and dying and other things, I realized people ask, is this a memoir? Well, it wasn't intended as such, but I feel like what I tend to write about is I write the way my heart feels. And my heart is drawn to other people, is drawn to community, is drawn to love and heartful stuff, you know? men and women alike. It's really beautiful. And that's me, and that's my survival. So in that sense, I guess it's in some way a survival memoir. Yeah. Survive and thrive is what I say.
That it is, yeah. How often, David, because you write in the book about wonderful successes at in public speaking and connecting with audiences, how often is it that you find yourself in an audience and finding that you're not able to connect, that it's not working out, say, with, you know, the people who are uninterested or who are distracted or who are outright disruptive?
You know, that tends to happen. That's pretty rare, because I develop my skills and I'm quite good at this, but you tend to, children, younger than 10, younger than 9, they don't have the same attention span, that's one thing. People who are at an event because they've been told to come and it's a work, employment obligation or something like that, it takes them a while to get in, you know. So those things happen. And I just remember one event at St. Thomas University that was in the Maritimes. And, it was like on a Friday afternoon. I was the last thing. I was doing it with Marlena. Uh-huh. And it was hot, and the language that translating, from English to French had fallen apart, and I just remember looking out, and people were all like taking naps, and so I remember that well. So there's times like that, but mostly, I recently spoke at on National Philanthropy Day in British Columbia, and a couple of talks, one in Victoria, then one in Kelowna. And what I do is, I used to, when I first started, as I was waiting to go to the podium, I'd be running my lines. I'd say, okay, I want to do this, I want to do that, and I want to do this, I want to do that. And then I'd forget what I wanted to say anyhow. And then I realized, that's in my head. I have to get into my heart. So I stopped doing it, and I started breathing into my chakras, or the energy centers. I didn't know much about them, but they were inside me, and I started being able to breathe into them and bring my energy inside my torso, inside my heart.
Yeah.
And so that I remember, I did this talk in Kelowna, British Columbia, and I got 6 ovations, including a standing ovation in the middle of my talk.
Wow.
And then another one at the end, and then another ovation, not stand, 6 total ovations. And that was because I didn't try to memorize or think of what I was going to say. I just wanted to come out there with an open heart. So, you know, there's ways that I do that. I show up early, and the people who are sitting in the back, I come around and tease them and tell them there's no smoking, you know, and and I just chat and connive. And then I get to know them as human beings, not as a bunch of unknowns out there.
Yeah.
Well, so, I'm good at that, yeah.
Yeah, you are good at that, and this book is a marvelous example of how you connect with audiences and with your heart as you do throughout your work. David, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today. Congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you, Joseph, and thank you for the depth that you bring to this interview.
You're really
helpful to me.
You're very welcome.
Yeah.
The website for more is at davidroche.com. The book is called Standing at the Back Door of Happiness and How I Unlocked It. It's from Harbor Publishing. Its author, David Roche, joined me on the line from Roberts Creek in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunto.